G'day world, 324, recorded May 2008. My name is Cameron Riley. You're listening to the Podcast Network. My guest today, very special guest, Dr. Susan Blackmore from the United Kingdom of Her Majesty. I've been a fan of Sue Blackmore's for at least 10 years since I read her very excellent book, The Meme Machine, and one of her subsequent books, Consciousness and Introduction. Now, Susan actually has quite a bit of research and experience to bring to the table tonight. She has a variety of degrees in psychology, physiology, environmental psychology, and a PhD in parapsychology. Actually spent the first couple of decades of her research career investigating parapsychology, coming from a position of belief. She actually had an experience when she was young where she had an astral travel out of body experience. Spent the next 25 years trying to find evidence about telepathy and astral travel and all these sorts of things. Ended up deciding there was none, or at least not enough for it to be considered valid. And has since then gone on to become an expert in the ideas of memes, amongst other things. Now, I invited Sue on because in some of the stuff that I've read of hers over the years, including the blog that she writes for The Guardian, it became obvious with a few throwaway lines that she'd made that she doesn't believe in free will. Now, regular listeners to the show know that I don't believe in free will either. I haven't for the last 20-odd years. And it's not often that I find somebody who agrees with me. It's even rarer to find somebody with a background in psychology and studying how the brain works to agree with me. So it was great to have her on. We had a great chat earlier this evening. And I hope you enjoy my chat tonight with Dr. Sue Blackmore. Sue, thanks very much for coming on the show. Now, this whole issue of free will, I've been talking to people about it for 20 years, and every time I do, I get this look like I must be absolutely crazy. In fact, even discussions I had with my shrink, who was a neuroscientist, he told me that it was, you know, my complete fabrication, it was my get-out-of-jail-free card, etc. You were one of the first people I've ever come across who actually agrees with me. You don't believe in free will either, correct?
Yes, absolutely. I'm not going to pull faces and go, don't understand, I'm right with you.
Well, let's start with a definition of the term free will, because when I get involved in these conversations, I quite often find that people are talking about something different to what I'm talking about. So what's your definition of free will?
Well, I try and stick to a really ordinary, everyday use of the term free will, something like the idea that we can think of doing something and by virtue of those thoughts cause something to happen. Or we can consciously decide to do something and because we've consciously decided it, it happens. Like I consciously decide to move my arm and it moves because I consciously decided it. I think that's the normal understanding of free will. Of course, philosophers will make all kinds of complicated definitions and talk about compatibility or incompatibility with determinism and so on, and move the idea of free will quite far away from its ordinary understanding. But I want to stick with that kind of ordinary understanding.
So we're not debating the fact that human beings have thoughts and that those thoughts sometimes lead to actions, are we?
No, exactly. And you put it exactly right. Thoughts precede actions in a lot of cases, but not always. And sometimes they come after the actions. And in any case, I would say they are not causal. At least the idea of a conscious thought, this is where the real problems lie, to do with self and consciousness. Because I think for many people, the idea of free will is intimately bound up with the nature of self and the nature of consciousness. So the idea is something like, I'm sitting in here inside my brain. I'm the one who has the conscious experiences. I'm the one who makes the conscious decisions. And because I make them, my arms and legs move and the words come out of my mouth. Now, that's really problematic when you start to think about, well, what is a self? Where could it possibly reside? What could it be? And what is consciousness, which, of course, is deeply mysterious with the hard problems of dualism, the mind-body problem, and all of that.
Well, the way I normally define free will is that you have to be able to demonstrate that you can create your thought outside of the realm of causality. So the thought wasn't going to happen anyway as a result of previous thoughts or chemical states. You have to have created this thought from scratch. You have to create it out of nothing.
Yes, I think that description is very close to mine. I mean, you're being more accurate there by saying it's outside of the realm of causality. I think that is what is implied when people imagine that their conscious self does this, because if a conscious self did that, it would be outside of causality, it would be magical.
From your work in this area, Sue, are you familiar with any scientific research that's been done that demonstrates that thoughts are something other than electrochemical events happening in the brain?
Well, there's lots that purports to do that. I spent about 25 years of my life as a parapsychologist, starting out initially as completely convinced of the existence of telepathy and clairvoyance and psychokinesis and precognition and all of these things. And after doing many years of experiments, becoming increasingly skeptical to the point where I'm as convinced as it's possible to be that there are no such things as telepathy, clairvoyance, precognition, psychokinesis, and so on, and all paranormal claims. But many of those paranormal claims would say that thoughts can operate outside of the brain that created them, that they can have effects at a distance, and so on. So it depends on how you interpret that evidence. For myself, after many, many years of research, I would say the evidence isn't good enough. But there are people out there who disagree with me. But then, leaving the paranormal aside, there's a question of what thoughts are. You see, what you said there kind of implies that you are going to take a reductionist view that thoughts are just chemical reactions or whatever in the brain. That is incredibly difficult to do philosophically, to make an identity theory like that work. I mean, how can thoughts be electrical activity in the brain? This is part of the hard problem of consciousness. It's part of the problem of intentionality and so on. So although, you know, I would personally think that in the end we will understand them that way, at the moment it's damn difficult to do so. So when you ask, is there any evidence to suggest otherwise, I would say no, but we are left with this difficult mystery, which is why I think that there are sort of loopholes for people to go on believing in the power of consciousness and free will and so on, because it is so very, very hard to see how thoughts, experiences, feelings and so on can just be firings of neurons in the brain. We've a long way to go in the science of consciousness, in other words.
I know there's been quite a bit of research done. Probably the most famous experiments were those done by Benjamin Libet or Libe. How do you pronounce that?
Libet. I asked him himself. I was delighted when I first met him, and we had wonderful discussions about free will and free won't and all sorts of other things, and he said his name is pronounced Libet.
Okay, Libet. Well, I'm glad you cleared that up for me. I've been wondering that for 20 years. Can you explain to us, just in brief, what Benjamin Libet's research involved?
Yes, he did a lot of research with open brain surgery, looking at delays in times between events, information coming into the brain, and conscious experiences. But the research which is most relevant to free will is his work on spontaneous deliberate actions. What he did was ask people in an experimental setting to hold out their arm in front of them, and whenever they felt like it, of their own free will, without any coercion, flex their wrist. So he was telling them what they had to do, but not when to do it. They had to decide spontaneously, I'll do it now, no, I won't, I'll wait, I'll do it. And they had to keep on doing that. The technological restraints he was working under, this is back in the mid-80s, meant that he had to keep them doing it many, many times and average over many trials using an EEG. Now it can be done with functional MRI and can be done a lot more easily and has indeed been repeated. But back then he was using EEG electrodes on the brain. So what he wanted to do was to ask the following question. When somebody flexes their wrist at a time of their own choosing, what is the first cause of that happening? Is it some kind of change in the brain, or is it the conscious decision to move, which he called W for will? And so he had to measure the timing of those things. It's easy to measure the action. You put electrodes on the wrist. It's easy to measure the start of brain activity. You put EEG electrodes on the motor cortex and measure the readiness potential, which was already long known to start somewhere between half a second and a second before a skilled action. But then he wanted to ask, well, when does the conscious decision to move act? Because if there's really free will, as he believed there was, and if consciousness really has power, then the conscious decision to move should come first, and the brain activity then start up after that, or at the same time as it. But it's very difficult to measure the moment that you decide to move. And this was really what was so clever about his research. He had a spot revolving on a screen, and he asked the people to call out where the spot was, like 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 5 o'clock, whatever it was, where the spot was at the moment they decided to move. And he could then, it didn't matter if it took take them a couple of seconds to say it, because that delay doesn't matter. What they're telling you is where the spot was at the moment they decided to move. And from that, he could work backwards and calculate the answer. And what he found was, greatly to his surprise, that the moment of the decision to act came about half a second after brain activity had already started in the motor cortex. In other words, the conscious decision to move was not the first thing that happened. The brain had already started sooner.
And as you said, some neuroscientists, I think at the Max Planck Institute earlier this year, redid similar experiments to Libet's, but using modern fMRI equipment, and basically came up with the same results.
Yes, they did, very, very much so, and they've extended them as well. I don't think there's really much disagreement about the results. The disagreement, and there is massive disagreement, there are hundreds and hundreds of articles written about this, and indeed whole books written about these experiments. The disagreement is about how to interpret it. You see, at a superficial level, it appears to show that free will can't exist, because the conscious decision to act comes too late. But then Libet did a whole lot more experiments in which he showed that people could decide to act and then veto their own action. And that the timing of this worked in such a way that, in fact, they were able, you were able to rescue the idea that you might be able to prevent yourself doing something rather than initiating the action. This led my friend Richard Gregory, professor of psychology here in Bristol, who's well known for all his work on illusions, to say, aha, Libet has proved we may not have free will, but we do have free won't. So this kind of veto argument runs through all the literature. Libet himself, I had a most interesting discussion with him, and he said that this was very important to him in ordinary life. We were walking along a street in San Francisco at the time, and there was a little kid running along the pavement in front. And he said, for example, what if I suddenly conceived an idea to murder that child or, you know, run over somebody or whatever? I couldn't be held responsible for that if these results are right, but I can prevent myself doing it. So we can still retain responsibility. And he is not alone in being among people who feel that these results might undermine the whole notion of human responsibility and even, you know, destroy society and, you know, everything would fall apart and we'd all be terrible. But there is a much more deep-seated kind of objection made primarily by Daniel Dennett, but also by other people, that the whole idea of measuring the moment of a conscious experience is itself fundamentally dualist. What Libet thought he was doing was measuring physical things on the one hand and mental things on the other. But in fact, what he was really doing was measuring two kinds of physical things. One, brain activity starting in the motor cortex, and two, the time at which people judge that they made a decision, and they do that by saying where the spot was. These are all physical things. You haven't directly measured a mental thing, and indeed, if there were such a thing as a conscious moment at which you decide, that would be dualist, which in many people's view, and my view, and possibly yours, would be magic.
Which gets me back to this idea that the brain is made of chemicals and electricity. And that you said before that this was a reductionist argument, and it is. I'm unabashedly reductionist because, as far as I can see, all of the evidence that we have points to the fact that thoughts, as amazing as it seems, are electrochemical events in the brain. And until there's some credible research that suggests otherwise, I think we need to go with that.
I think that's right. And I think that's why Dennett's interpretation of Libet's experiments is important, because whichever way Libet was looking at it, and many of the people who agree with him, there's magic in there. There's thoughts acting outside of just being physical effects in the brain. Whereas if we try to think about it all in terms of physical effects, we can easily understand how it is that people come to say that they consciously decided at a certain point, because that's the point at which the information was available to the verbal system, which enabled them to speak. So it is much better, I think, to interpret those experiments that way. You might also like to think about the experiments done by Daniel Wegener, who has done a lot of experiments on trying to find out why and when people attribute actions to themselves. And it turns out that you can manipulate this variable in very clever ways. And his book, The Illusion of Conscious Will, is full of experiments of this kind, in which he either manipulates somebody to think that they did the action when in fact someone else did it, or manipulate them to think someone else did it when in fact they did. And when you've got this double dissociation, you can say, look, we can show that when you genuinely believe that you acted of your own free will, that's an attribution that you're making. It isn't necessarily true. So the fact that people feel so strongly that they have free will does not prove that they do. Now, this is not evidence that they don't, but it is evidence that the fact that we feel so strongly about it is no proof at all of what's going on.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I want to talk to you about the consequences of living a life without this concept of free will, and some of the things that Libet mentioned to you as you were walking down the street together. But first, I just want to drill down on some of the regular objections that I get when I'm talking to people about free will. For example, I mean, I'm normally talking about this whole idea of brain chemistry. As far as I'm concerned, if people are suggesting that they can create a thought outside of causality and the brain is made of chemistry, then they basically are arguing that they can create a chemical reaction in their brain without any other prior chemical events affecting it, which is kind of like magic.
And people, yeah,
it'd be crazy magic, wouldn't it?
It would be magic. But the thing that always gets me is people say, aha, but it's quantum mechanics. There are quantum events happening in my brain. And we all know that quantum events aren't causal, they're random, therefore I have free will.
That doesn't help at all. And quantum mechanics will allow superpositions of things. It has all sorts of mysterious properties that go on at quantum level. It will also allow for truly, or some interpretations of quantum mechanics at any rate, will allow for truly random processes which cannot be predicted even in principle. But adding truly random processes to the laws of chemistry doesn't make for free will. Free will is by its very nature directed by something. In other words, the conscious self, or the person who wants to direct it. So it's not random. So quantum mechanics doesn't help at all.
My usual response to the quantum mechanics argument is to say, oh, right, so now you're telling me that you can control the spin of electrons or the superimposition of subatomic particles with your mind. Can you show me how you do that, please? I'm fascinated. Are there any other genuine scientific objections to free will that you're aware of?
I think almost everything in all of science, in a way, impacts on the question of free will. The whole building picture of science that we live in a causally closed universe, that everything that happens in the universe happens because of the things that happened before, is all of it. The whole of science is building up a picture that there is no room for and no need for something right outside of that system that comes in and messes it up. But that's why I mentioned the whole paranormal stuff, because there are plenty of people out there who claim that there are these things, or aliens from outer space, or perhaps that's too silly, but there are examples of, you know, spirits of the dead coming back and telepathic effects and the effects of astrology on us and so on. All of those things are very popular claims, and a lot of people believe in them, and they would be magical. And against them, science goes on building and building and building and showing that, firstly, that these things don't happen, don't lead to testable predictions, don't work out, and secondly, that we don't need them to understand how the human brain works, how societies work, or how anything works, really.
I like that term you used, the causally closed universe. Is that a fancy schmancy way of saying predeterminism?
No, it's not. Predeterminism means things are determined in advance and must go in a given way, given the starting point of the universe. Causally closed is more open than that. You can have that first one would preclude random effects, whereas a causally closed universe can have random effects in if you want or not if you want. But the fact is there aren't magical causes coming from outside and interfering with it.
Can you give me an example of a random effect that doesn't have a cause?
Well, quantum effects. In some interpretations of quantum mechanics, you can have decay of a particle into two other particles, which is in principle unpredictable. It will happen at a completely unpredictable time. So it is truly random. So that is compatible with a causally closed universe. There isn't a cause for that thing, but nor is there an outside magical cause like free will coming in and making it happen. It just happens. Decay, radioactive decay, just goes along in an unpredictable way.
At a Newtonian.
Hey, but I'm not a physicist. You shouldn't be asking me about these kind of things.
Okay, I'll move on.
So the next thing I wanted to talk to you about was this idea of free will as a meme. It seems to be a very sticky, a very strong meme. I mean, I've had plenty of discussions with people over the years where we'll have a lengthy debate about free will, and at the end of the discussion, they will essentially agree with me and say, okay, well, it's now obvious to me that free will is an illusion. However, there's always this however at the end of it. They say, however, I just can't possibly exist. I can't possibly accept that free will doesn't exist, or, it must exist, even though all of the evidence points against it. Why is it so sticky?
Well, I think you're right that it's a meme and that it's a very sticky meme. I think what makes it sticky is a very big deal indeed. It is the whole nature of the way we think about self. And I don't understand, and I don't think anybody understands, the basis of this, really. But it does seem to be the case that we human beings find it very hard to think of ourselves as machines, as collections of chemicals and neurons and things that we can't actually see. And it's much easier from very early on, and particularly once we start as children learning language, or as babies learning language, it is much easier to see ourselves as agents who live inside our bodies and own our bodies. And this kind of tradition you find in endlessly in all sorts of religions, you find it in spiritual traditions as well, you find it all over the place, that I am not my body, I am something else. Some people would say, Paul Bloom, for example, would say we are natural-born dualists. It's perhaps just because it's cognitively easier to think that way, perhaps because there are some inbuilt evolutionary biases, I don't know. But it's certainly the case that children from a very early age will think of themselves as an agent, and it's not the whole body that is the agent, it is me. Some little me inside my head, or the real me, the inner me, something like that. And that permeates our language and permeates our culture. So it's actually very difficult, though not impossible, to rethink it all and throw off that idea.
Yeah, people seem to fall back to this position that, well, I'm the spirit, I'm the soul, although nobody can ever define what that actually means for me. They seem to stick with that.
Yes, and I think it's not exactly the same thing as free will, but I think it is very much bound up with free will. Because when you really push people about, well, when you act of your own free will, what is it that's acting? If they believe in a soul or a spirit, they'll take that route. If they don't believe in a soul or a spirit, they'll say, well, it's my conscious self. And a conscious self is really not so different conceptually. It's very often what people mean by a conscious self is a sort of mysterious inner me who has this power of consciousness to affect things.
We talk about it being a very sticky meme, but you and I both live our lives without believing in free will. I haven't believed in it for 20-odd years, and I know that you don't believe it, and yet you seem to lead a very busy, active life. You're in the process of moving house, I know, at the moment, with no free will involved. How do you go about living your life on a daily basis without this free will concept?
Oh, I want to ask you that question first. Can I ask you how you managed to do it? How you did it in the beginning? You say it's been 20 years. And how did you make that transition?
Well, about 20 years ago, when I was in my late teens, I met this guy, this guru fella who had been over to India and spent some time with a famous guru. And I was in a particularly sticky part of my life, and I had lots of issues I was trying to deal with. And He said to me one day, you know what, your problem is that you think you're in control of your mind, but you're really not. And I spent the next year of my life basically examining that and trying to figure out what the hell he was talking about. And I came to the conclusion that he was right. You know, when I watched very carefully the way that my mind worked, I saw that thoughts just seemed to appear spontaneously. I didn't say I'm going to think a thought. It just appeared. And some of those thoughts then turned into new thoughts and there were actions involved and other thoughts just got drowned out by secondary thoughts that came along. And so, you know, since then I've just woken up every day and lived my life. Thoughts appear and I just seem to be going along for the ride, really.
Excellent. And does this lead you astray into being wicked and destroying everything?
Well, I don't know if it's the cause of my wickedness, but yes, I'm wicked. I think I'm as wicked as, you know, a normal person, but, you know, I live a fairly normal life. I'm married, got a couple of kids, I run a business. My life doesn't seem to be anything out of the ordinary. I just don't believe I'm in control of these thoughts or the actions that come out of them. Otherwise, my life is, you know, pretty normal.
That's what people seem to fear, that it would be impossible. And you and I show that it's not. So let me go back and answer your question then. I struggled with concepts of free will a long time ago, but I don't remember the beginning, but probably when I was a teenager. Certainly on and off in my 20s, I thought about it. And I had religious phases early on before I became a firm atheist. And they affected it as well. On one side, it was an intellectual endeavor that it seemed to me that free will can't exist because the more science I learned, the more there didn't seem to be any room for free will. But on the other hand, was something much more like your experience, which was I began practicing Zen meditation nearly 30 years ago now. And within that, as you've said, are skills for sitting and watching thoughts and realizing that they just pop up, for watching your attempts to be somebody who can suppress the thoughts and failing, going on through realizing that the self you thought was so important can actually be let go and there can be experiences without an experiencer. And all of those things made it much, much easier to the point where, I can't say how long ago, but certainly more than 10 years ago, but I don't know really how much more, I simply stopped really believing in free will anymore. And in fact, I think it was probably a prolonged period of mindfulness practice back in the mid-80s that I did that probably put the final nail in the coffin. And I was able then to live quite happily without believing in free will, whereas before it had been a kind of struggle. And so now I find the sort of temptation of free will does sometimes get me. You know, there's a big decision to make, like, as you said, we're about to move house. And, you know, should we buy this house or not? You know, it seems like free will that decides it. And sometimes with decisions like that, the thought comes up, help, you know, I've got to use my free will. And then I find myself going through the old routine that I've had for so long of saying, the decision will happen. It will be made. She will make the decision according to everything she knows about this house and feels about this house and everything else. Just get on with the job of thinking, is it a good house, and, you know, doing the whole process, and the decision will be made. And indeed, the decision is made. And so, like you, I find actually I could go on living this life, and decisions are made and things happen, and I go on.
Have you noticed any subjective benefits to the way you live your life since you stopped believing in free will?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Although the trouble is with longitudinal things like that, you know, it seems to me that these benefits follow from this, but, you know, who knows? I can't run the experiment again to find out. Okay. But it seems to me, yeah, huge relief of this ghastly burden. It somehow shifts the nature of responsibility. And people seem to be terrified that it will take away all responsibility, and it really doesn't seem to do that. I think I behave as much as a responsible person as I ever did. But within myself, I'm not attributing that responsibility to me, because I don't think there is such a thing. I'm attributing that responsibility to this body, this person who lived this life, who was brought up in this way, infected with these memes, born with these genes, and these decisions are a product of that person in this environment. It's very much easier to both forgive myself when decisions prove not to have been too great, to understand the decisions, and above all, to live with the decisions that she makes. Because so, I say, well, always think those are the decisions that were made in those circumstances. That's what I now live with. And I find that hugely easier than believing in free will ever was.
I always say that every decision you make was the only possible decision you could have made at that exact point in time based on your brain architecture at that point in time.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the trouble is that gets you into all kinds of philosophical arguments about causality and randomness and all the other things we were talking about. So I have some hesitations not being a great philosopher, but yes, I think generally I would say exactly that, yes.
In terms of the benefits, I have found I wouldn't say complete elimination, but a very, very significant reduction in things like guilt, anxiety, fear of the future. Have you found a similar sort of result?
Yes, absolutely. Guilt in particular. I wasn't brought up a Catholic, and they unfortunately have the worst problems with it, but certainly my Christian Church of England upbringing had quite a lot of guilt involved in it, and my mother was rather good at putting guilt on me. And it makes a huge difference when you accept that these decisions are made, you know, for reasons of the environment and the genes and the memes and everything. There's no room for guilt anymore. There is room for remorse in the sense of, you know, when I see that I, this person, made a bad decision and see bad consequences, I will feel sorry and sad about that and try to, you know, make things better and so on. But that is fine. That's not like the awful burden of guilt which is so related to yourself and, oh, I'm a bad person and I'm wicked and it's my fault. And all of that stuff goes.
So if you do something that hurt somebody else, that you can feel sorry, you can be sad, you can be remorseful, you can try to make amends, but you don't feel the guilt associated with that because you know that you were living out your programming. So
exactly right. I think obviously seems to me from what you're saying that we agree that, you know, we've had a very parallel experiences and very much feel the same way about it.
We have. It's great to meet somebody who's got a similar perspective on these things. Before we move on, I want to talk a little bit about the legal and moral consequences of not believing in free will, to harken back to what you were talking about with Libet when you were walking down the street. So if you commit a crime, let's say you walk out of your room after this podcast and you kill one of the removalists that's there, should you face the full legal consequences for that, seeing as we both agree that you don't have any free will?
Yes, I think you should. I think it's very interesting because so many people, amongst the very many ways they try to say it's impossible to live without free will, they will say, yes, but society would fall apart, the legal system would fall apart, and, you know, everything would be disastrous. But the legal system wouldn't fall apart. The legal system depends really on three kinds of effects. One is kind of punishing people because they're bad and wicked, and therefore you should punish them. Which has to go under this view of a causally closed universe and no free will. But you retain the other two, which are that you will punish people in order to provide a deterrent, either for that person in the future or for other people, and that you punish people, like put them in prison, for example, in order to keep them off the streets and prevent them doing whatever it was again. So the legal system would have to change to some extent, in its kind of philosophy, but we would still have prisons and fines and all kinds of benefits and punishments to try to build a society in which people on the whole behaved well towards each other. So I think there would be no problem. And in fact, we would get out of, I think, some of the ludicrous things we get into where people say, you know, oh, it wasn't me, it was the food I ate, or it wasn't me, it was my genes, or it wasn't me, you know, as though the law has to be punishing you. If we take that right out of it and say, right, you know, you are a person, genes, memes, food and everything, that person, is it appropriate to put them in prison or fine them or whatever, and ask that question free of assumptions about conscious selves and free will, then I think we could build a better legal system.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, we need to have laws to protect people and remove people if they're a danger. Whether or not you have free will, if you're running around harming people, then you need to be taken off the streets or you need to be put into some sort of rehabilitation. It's got nothing to do with free will. Sue, thank you so much for chatting with me tonight. I know you're really busy and in the middle of packing. Thanks for coming on. I really had a great time chatting with you.
So have I. It's really interesting talking to somebody who has had a very, very similar experience. And like you, I'm constantly meeting people who say, well, it can't be true. You can't live without free will. I tell you, the most common thing I get is people say, well, you have to live as if there's free will or you couldn't live. And you and I are examples that say that isn't so. I don't live as if there's free will. I accept that there isn't free will and I live without it. And I'm very delighted to talk to someone else who does the same.
And tell me, the other scientists you've spoken to during your work and your research, the other neuroscientists, the people who study consciousness, do they accept that there's no free will, or do they understand the science but yet still cling to this idea of free will in their daily lives?
To my horror, most of them believe in it anyway. In my book, Conversations on Consciousness, I interviewed 20 well-known philosophers and psychologists and neuroscientists who work on consciousness, and I asked all of them some standard questions, including, do you have free will? And I was completely shocked that almost all of them said, well, yes, of course. Some said no. Dan Wegener was very interesting. He said, no, I don't think there's such a thing as free will, but I live as if I have free will. John Searle said, well, it's absolutely ridiculous to say you couldn't possibly live without free will. Dan Dennett, I'm sorry to say, he's my great hero in many respects, but when it comes to free will, he defines it in such a way that he says we have it, and so he says, of course I have free will. I think he really means just that we have choice, but that's fun. So he was sure about it. Susan Greenfield said, well, don't be ridiculous. You can't mean that when you walk into a restaurant and order the spaghetti, you're saying, oh, I wonder what she will order. And I said, yeah, that's exactly how it is, but you didn't believe me. The only one of that whole group who rejected it and lived without it was Kevin O'Regan, who is well known for his sensory motor theories, quite extreme theories of the nature of vision. And he said ever since he was a kid, he'd accepted that he was a kind of a robot and had been through a similar process, really, and lived without believing in free will. But he was the only one. And I've talked to many, many other people, similar people, and it's the same throughout. Nearly all of these neuroscientists who will tell you, if you ask them, well, yes, of course, the brain is doing this and everything can be explained in terms of the chemistry ultimately and so on and so on and so on, and then they will somehow say at the end of all that, well, yes, of course, I have free will because I must have and they're becoming coherent.
The term cognitive dissonance comes to mind.
Indeed.
The restaurant example I like, because for many, many years when I'm at a restaurant with somebody and they say, so what are you going to order? I say, I really don't know, and I'm not going to know until the waiter is standing right next to me and asks me what I'm going to order. Because how many times have you thought you were going to order one thing and then all of a sudden at the sudden moment you change your mind? So, you just give into it.
And isn't it nice just to enjoy and watch and enjoy that process rather than agonizing and going, oh dear, I must make the right decision.
And it applies to every other aspect of life as well. It doesn't matter, if I'm having relationship troubles or some other sort of personal situation or business situation, you can sit there and stress over what you're going to do or why did you get into this situation, how did it happen, what are you going to do tomorrow or next week if this happens or that happens. But if you don't believe in free will, you know that, okay, well, you're going to do what you're going to do, the brain's going to function the way it's engineered to function. There's nothing I can do about it right now. There's nothing I can do about the past. There's nothing I can do about the future. I might as well sit here and enjoy my coffee and read my book. And there's such a diminished level of stress and anxiety that comes with that and guilt. I don't know why more people don't just accept the fact that there's no free will and live a much less stressful life.
Well, perhaps they will when they listen to this.
Perhaps they will. Dr. Susan Blackmore, thank you again for taking the time to chat to us. It's been fun.
Not at all. It was fun talking to you. Bye.